Welcome to American Sailing Stories. I'm Gary Jobson. Several years ago, I got to sit down for a good interview with Lowell North, one of the most productive and successful sailors in American history. North grew up in Southern California and quickly got himself into the star class. Along the way, he won a gold medal in the star in the Olympic Games, won 5 world championships, finished 2nd 5 times, and got 2 bronze medals in star world championships. He also created the largest sailmaking company in the world. At first, he worked with cotton sails and as a 15-year-old, simply tinkered, adjusting the shape of sails, but he could make them go faster. In fact, his friend, a year or so older, Malin Burnham, recruited Lowell to sail with him in the Star World Championship. In 1944, the two crossed the United States from San Diego to Long Island Sound with their star boat during World War II and won the Star World Championship. Quite a feat for 2 teenagers. As Lowell approaches his 90th birthday on December 2nd, 2019, I think it's a fitting time to go back to hear his thoughts on how he developed his skills, built North Sails into the powerhouse it is today, and reflect on his amazing career. Well, first of all, you went to Cal Berkeley.
Yes.
What did you study there, Cal Berkeley?
Civil engineering.
And was that a big help to you with sailmaking later?
I think it really was. It was basically the engineering part of it, just because after cotton went away and Dacron came into play, sailmaking became a little bit more of an engineering problem than it was an art, let's say.
What were some of the engineering problems?
Well, measuring the stretch of cloth and figuring out how to design a sail so it would stretch in the right direction and the shape would change in the right way.
As a kid, were you always taking things apart and putting them back together?
When I first got a starboat, I took my sail apart and put it back together probably 20 times.
And every time just making little changes?
I actually didn't take it all apart. I was just taking a seams apart and making changes to make it look better. I thought when I started making sails that I knew what a sail should look like. And sails were pretty, really bad. When I first started making sails, it was pretty easy because most of the sails were really bad. So to make a better sail was far easier than it is nowadays.
Was your collegiate sailing career helpful?
Yeah, it was helpful, but I didn't do as much collegiate sailing as the kids do now. We went back east and sailed at the Naval Academy for a week, or for a regatta. And I went to another regatta in the MIT River Basin and sailed there in the MIT Tech dinghies. The college sailing now is really complete. I mean, it gives you an education in how to race and sail, and I didn't gain that from the college sailing. I got it from sailing small boats, snipes and lightnings and stars, mostly stars.
Is it fair to say that your small boats are in your heart?
Yeah, for sure.
Not the big boats?
Not the big boats. I got seasick on big boats.
You got seasick?
You bet. The first 2 or 3 races, long distance races I went in, I was so sick I could barely, almost too sick to sail, but not quite. Just couldn't eat anything.
Now, early in your career, I think you were working with skis, making skis?
Well, we built some skis where I worked at Narmco. I was chief engineer there and had access to the equipment and tools. And head skis had just become popular and were selling like hotcakes. So I thought up a way to make a ski a little better than a head ski. Principally, the head skis were losing edges. They'd flop the edges every once in a while, and you wouldn't be able to ski without the steel edge. So Dick Cantner was the fellow that helped me. He and I made this pair of skis with using steel as the bottom and top of the ski, and the steel bottom the edge became integral with the steel part of the bottom of the ski, so the edge couldn't fly off. The whole bottom of the ski would have to fly off, and we made it so it didn't do that. So they were reasonable skis, and we thought they'd be better than heads. There was a market. I thought there was a market for them, but the company didn't want to make the skis, and they wouldn't give me permission to subcontract them out to somebody else and market them because they figured that would interfere with my due diligence on my job. I was sort of chief engineer. And that really pissed me off a great deal. So I quit and started making sails a few months later.
Otherwise, maybe we would have had North Skis instead of North Sails.
Well, I think I'm very fortunate that I couldn't make the skis because I don't think I would have been successful at ski making, or as successful for sure.
So you started out with your star, recutting the sail, and that was before you made a sail loft.
This was cotton sail.
Cotton sail.
Before a Dacron.
So the cotton sail needed to be changed all the time to keep a shape?
Yeah, if it got damp, it changed automatically. And if it rained, the sail would become completely different, as you may remember. Do you ever use a cotton sail? Mm-hmm. So you know about cotton sails. They're really bad news.
I just got the tail end of that in the early 50s of that. Well, you must have been something when you saw this Dacron come along.
That was pretty nice, yeah. That was ideal.
Did you ever figure out where your inventive tendency to tinker and test comes from?
Well, my dad had quite a few patents to his name.
Really, what kind of patents?
He worked for Amerada Oil, and some of them were within that industry, and some of them were with electronic stuff. He built his own ham radio, for instance, and liked diddling with electronics, and his first job at Convair, he went to work for Consolidated Bull T, which is now Convair. His job was to take the, when they were flying a new airplane, his job was to take all the data from the strain gauges and from all the other instruments on the plane and transmit it to the ground and record it on the ground so they would have a record of it in case the plane crashed.
And then at an early age, I think maybe you were 15 and Malin Burnham was 17 and you broke into the star ranks. That must have been kind of exciting.
Yeah, I don't think no one has won the world's younger than Malin was then, 17. That was the youngest and still is the record, I think.
Is a star boat the best boat you've ever sailed?
Yep.
What's so special about the star boat?
Well, the people are nice and friendly and hospitable, and you go to foreign countries and there's always a star sailor that you can talk to and get together with. And it's a beautiful boat and it sails well and it's fun to sail. And
so were you getting sales going because you just couldn't find anything satisfactory in the market, so you needed to do your own sales?
No, there were good sales for stars anyway. I used Murphy and Nye sales to win the first star Worlds that I won in Havana, Cuba. And then I had made a jib with the help of the local sailmaker, Herb Sinhofer, and we used that jib, I think, in one or two races. It was a light weather jib and the wind blows pretty hard in Havana, but we did have a couple of light days. I just went in the sailmaking business because I had to do something to make a living, having been fired. That was the real reason. My wife was pregnant, about to have a baby, and she was making a good living, and she continued to work for about 4 or 5 months after we found out she was pregnant, since I started the company while we were still living off her salary. Malin invited me to crew for him because he figured my sail was maybe a little better than his sail, and I thought it was too, because we could beat him in light air. And he knew that he was a better sailor than I was. I knew that too. So the only reason I could beat Malin in light air was because I had a better sail, a mainsail. And that's because I'd taken it apart about 20 times, put it back together, and it got a little, by accident, it maybe got a little better, at least at times. And this was a cotton sail.
So it's kind of ironic, you know, you're beating Malin with this faster sail, so he says, hey, why don't you come sail with me, but bring your sail with
exactly.
you?
Exactly. So I got to crew for him, and I got to bring my sail, and we were fast.
And so that and the combination of you get fired because you wanted to build skis with the company, so you quit, you're out, so I'm going to get into sail. So they did you a big favor.
Yeah, you bet.
Did our sport a favor. You know, you talk about the Tigers, the Dick Devers, the Tom Blackhullers, the Schnackenbergs, Peter Barrett. Why did you call these people the Tigers?
I guess I'd gone to one of these how to do it courses that was a pretty good one, how to run your business better and how to be a, and they presented the theory that you had to be a tiger and how to be a tiger and how to choose your tigers. And so everybody knew about my tigers, I mean, in the company, because I talked about it and told them what I'd learned. And so I needed to have tigers that would go out and do it a little better than anybody else would do it. So I collected a bunch of tigers.
What were the attributes you look for in your tigers?
Mostly because of not being able to hire a psychologist to go out and pick the, you know, on the way they do it now or the way that a fancy company would do it. I just picked people that had mostly won medals in the Olympics and other yachting world championships. So you might notice that most of my tigers were all champion sailors.
So let's just talk about a few of them. Peter Barrett, the engineer from Wisconsin, you recruited him to come to California.
Right.
What did Peter bring to the table?
Well, he brought everything, and he had, on top of being a tiger and an engineer, and he was a lawyer. He had passed the bar in Wisconsin. But he was a people guy. He was a super guy. You know Peter Barrett. But Peter could, you could put six tigers in a room with Peter and they'd come out like pussycats, you might say. Or, in fact, when the company was growing, we were trying to decide what to do with it. And we had a choice of going public or doing this or doing that. And I really didn't want to go public because of the pains and the paperwork, and I hate that sort of thing. I don't think I'd ever want to be involved in a public company, or would have been. So we decided not to go public and not to try to sell the company back to ourselves or employees, whatever you call that, an ESOP, I guess you call that. We thought about that. But we offered our company to sale to a few companies that were buying companies like ours. And they told us that there was no way anybody could buy our company because it was made up of about 25 different corporations. And they said there's no way they could put that together. They said, you have to change the structure of the company and make it one corporation. So Peter was given that task. And so Peter was able to take these 25 corporations, I'm not sure how many there were, but 20 or 25, were owned mostly, I own 60% of the stock and the tiger owned 40%. It was a 60-40 combination. So Peter's job was to convince these tigers to put their 40% of stock in this big bowl and pull out one share of a new stock that would be the new company. And they would be told how much of the new company they would get. That was negotiated. But only Peter Barrett could do that sort of thing. And he did it. He did a fantastic job, and it actually worked. And that's what happened.
And of course, you and Peter teamed up to get a gold medal and a star.
Yes.
So do you think that moment, getting that gold medal, suddenly a lot of people were paying attention to North Sales? Was that a transition point for you?
Yeah, I think it was.
So how much of your time are you worrying about building fast sales and developing fast sales versus worrying about all the business aspects?
I never worried about the business aspects, ever. I mean, hardly ever. The bad debts were pretty small in those days, and that was one of our worries. But it was less than 1%.
So the year is 1977. You're out there on Enterprise, and a lot of technology is breaking all over the place. The green garbage bag jib, the brown cloud mainsail, the Frisbee main. What was happening in that mid-70s that you were able to suddenly have all this diverse new fabrics, shapes? What was going on at that time?
I was spending most of my time trying to get the instruments to work on that boat, which turned out to be pretty useless. We didn't have two boats to test, so the only thing we could do is go out with instruments and record the performance and hope that it was right and then see which was better. And one of the things we didn't find out was that the boat couldn't tack. The program that Heiner had developed that gave us sail shapes figured out that the boat would be faster with a small fore triangle and a bigger mainsail. So, because the area could be switched back and forth. And that was probably faster in a straight line, but it turned out that it couldn't tack. And we didn't learn that for some reason until it was a little bit too late.
What was it like working with Olin Stevens?
Well, Olin was a great guy. I sailed with Olin a fair bit on some of his boats. He was the best.
He won America's Cup 8 times, 14 Bermuda races, yeah. And still going at, I think he's 98 or 99 years old.
Yeah, he is amazing.
So, mid-80s now, why did you decide to sell the company? Are you glad you did, looking back?
Yeah, looking back, I'm glad I did, because I never could have come close to doing what Terry Kohler's done with the company. The 3DL has been a great success, but it was a huge expense.
We got to look at it with some pride to see how dominant North Sales is in the world today.
Yeah, I mean, Terry's done a really good, wonderful job. And of course, with a lot of help from his Tigers, like Tom Wooden and the rest of the Tigers, Gary Weissman and everybody else. So I didn't have the wherewithal to do what Terry did. I couldn't have come close.
Does it give you a sense of pride to kind of smile and say North Sales has got the greatest market share of any sail maker of any time?
Yeah, I can feel proud that I figured out Terry Kohler was the right guy to buy it, I think, because we came close to selling it to a guy that ran a ski mountain in Vermont. I don't know if you ever heard the story, but John Marshall and Jimmy Crane found a buyer for the company about the same time Peter Barrett found Terry Kohler. So there was a big political scramble as to whether we should sell it to the ski company in Vermont, and John Marshall and Jimmy were very much in favor of that, or whether we should sell it to Terry Kohler. And so we had a meeting with the ski people, so everybody was there, and it became a very big political battle between the ski lodge people and the Terry Kohler people. And again, Peter Barrett, being the people guy, he convinced him that Terry Kohler was the right guy. And I thought so too. The ski people just didn't seem like they were the right people to take over the company and make it a success. So we finally, the Terry Kohler people won the battle.
Is the perfect sale achievable?
I think it's achievable, yeah, for a particular boat. And there are probably a lot of sails now that are close enough in shape so that it's pretty hard to make a faster one. And it gets harder every year.
And a lot of competition out there, too.
There is a lot of competition.
In your wildest dreams 50 years ago, did you think North would be where it is today?
No, I had no wild dreams that wild.
Bull North is a perfect example of someone that came up with great ideas when he was young, had the work ethic to carry it out, one on the water, one on land as a businessman, and is one of the most productive sailmakers of our era. Thanks for listening to our podcast, American Sailing Stories. Please join us in the future when we talk to more great sailors. I'm Gary Jobson.